Hello, sea creatures and sweaty voyeurs and all the ships at sea, and welcome to A Very Good Year, the movie podcast where we invite a guest to pick a favorite year of movies and talk to us about that year. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hall.
Our guest today is a truly gifted film critic and historian. He reviews new releases for the New York Times and RogerEbert.com. For more than a decade, he was a senior editor and the chief film critic for the late lamented Premiere magazine. His byline has also appeared at the Los Angeles Times, Rolling Stone, The Village Voice, Entertainment Weekly, Vanity Fair Online, Decider, the Criterion Collection website, and many more. He is also the author of several books, including the acclaimed Made Men, The Story of Goodfellas. His latest tome, which is really excellent, is The World Is Yours, The Story of Scarface. And it's out May 7th from Hanover Square Press. Please welcome a man I consider both an influence and a friend, Glenn Kenny. Hey, buddy.
Hey, thank you. Great to be here. Thank you for having me. I'm really delighted to be able to speak with you today.
Yeah, well, it's always a pleasure to get to talk either on or off the mic. You're here primarily to promote your excellent new book, so let's start there. You published the Goodfellas book back in 2020, which we loved. What led you to Scarface as the next subject worthy of this sort of time and energy and analysis?
I thought I'd do something counterintuitive. This was not a good idea. I thought, well, I don't want to do another gangster film, you know, because you know, I don't want to be ghettoized in terms of writing books about genre films. And so I chose something that was different. I chose a romantic comedy. And I got the contract for that, and I got 6 months into researching it, and then it fell apart rather harrowingly in terms of both the narrative and sudden drying up of people willing to talk to me. Which is a whole other situation. And I realized I wasn't going to be able to write this book at all. So then I doubled back and I said, well, let's see about that whole ghettoizing thing. a long, long time ago, I had formulated an idea for a book about Scarface, a different kind of idea, not the book that we eventually ended up doing. And so I went back to that with my publisher, and they were keen on that. So, you know, then I started researching that, and it was I am now completely at ease with writing books about genre films, let's say. I will write books about gangster films and horror movies. I just signed a contract for the third book in my imagination, the story of The story right. of books are my Hanover Square yeah. Press film books. I have now signed a contract to do the third one. I won't say what film it is because we're still, it's going to be a couple of years and I want to surprise people, but I'm delighted to be doing this. And, you know, it sort of feels like sometimes counterintuitive isn't the best fit, honestly. there were several reasons that the proposed book didn't work out. And one of them was, you know, I eventually had to contend with the fact that the book I was writing about was one that I didn't really like as much as I probably should have if I were going to write a book about it. So, and now that the, you know, with the bad memories of how the whole thing went south, it's a film I never even want to see again, let alone mention the title of. So sure. Scarface it became. And Scarface is a movie I have a somewhat different relationship to than Goodfellas, because I was a younger man when it came out. I was in my early 20s. I wasn't yet a professional film writer. When Goodfellas was happening, I was at a magazine, and you know, in Made Men, there's the story recounting my meeting of director Martin Scorsese during the editing of that film. So I had a more professional relationship with that film, even though I was a huge enthusiast for the film and for Scorsese's work. So somehow Scarface feels different to me in terms of just how young I was when I saw it and the formative years of my cinephilia. So in a way, it was somewhat more intimidating to approach Brian De Palma than it was to approach Martin Scorsese, strangely enough.
Interesting.
He's also Brian would be Mr. De Palma. Brian would be the first to admit also that he can be perceived as brusque and sure. abrupt in his social or professional interactions.
Sure.
I had a fine time with him, actually. I got great stuff from him, and he actually he approves of the book. He I sent him the
nice
galley with great trepidation, and he sent me a very kind note.
Scarface was not all that well received initially. Why do you think it has persevered as it has, at risk of asking you to, you know, summarize a primary thesis of the book and, you know, two
there's,
minutes,
but there's two reasons. It had enormous home video coattails, mm-hmm. and also it became very popular with hip hop artists.
Sure.
To the extent that it led to the creation of a double CD compilation of music inspired by Scarface. Right. There had been talk of, attaching the music inspired by Scarface to the films, getting rid of the film's Giorgio Moroder score and putting in these hip hop right. Tunes, which Brian De Palma most vociferously opposed.
Sure.
Certainly the video games have hip-hop music on them, for sure, and that's mm-hmm. a part of what makes them commercially successful. But, you got a lot of Welcome to the Terror Dome when Flavor mm-hmm. Flav repeats the who put this together? Me. Who do I trust? Me. From Scarface.
Right.
The very fact of a rapper who actually names himself Scarface.
Right.
I have a whole chapter in the book where I discuss this with Harry Allen, the former media assassin. Public
yeah.
enemy, and longtime very astute hip hop creator and critic. And I think that was part of what helped make it a cult. It's also what made Goodfellas kind of a cult film, was being repeated by comedians,
Right.
Comedians like to repeat how am I funny. They also, how am I say hello to my little friend is a meme now. So,
right.
The internet culture and hip hop culture and all that stuff sort of keep perpetuating Scarface in ways that nobody could ever have predicted. And I think to this day, De Palma himself, his reaction to its popularity in hip hop is one of bemusement. But, Michelle Pfeiffer is also, she says, everywhere I go, and I don't know why they feel compelled to, talk to me about it, because they're not quoting my dialogue, because, people will tell me how they can, quote, all of Al Pacino's dialogue in Scarface and,
right.
They do impersonations and how they know the movie backwards and forwards and, and she accepts this with good grace, but she's also rather astonished by it. So,
yeah.
It's nice that it has those coattails and the popularity of it and, its ostensible memification means that it's something people are still interested in reading about. So I think it's a good time for this. Last year was the 40th anniversary of its mm-hmm. release, so we're mm-hmm. coming in on that. We're also coming in, we're releasing it close to Father's Day. That's very
always
important.
Good.
Because, Tony Montana loved kids.
He did. All right, well, the book again is The World Is Yours, The Story of Scarface. We will mention it again at the end of the show. In the meantime, Glenn, what year did you choose to talk with us about today and why?
Well, because all of your previous guests chose the most obvious years, I decided to go with 1954, which when you say 1954, people mm-hmm. say, what kind of a year is 1954? But then, the films mm-hmm. themselves, it's a fascinating thing. 1954 sounds like very meh. Nothing, what's going on? There are no revolutions in cinema afoot,
Right.
Citizen Kane was 41. Italian neorealism was 46 through 49. The French New Wave doesn't start until 59. So what's 1954? It's a nothing year, except the films themselves.
Yeah.
And I say that again, except the films themselves. And those films are, no, we're not going to say it yet, but you tell me, what's 1954 to you two?
I mean, one of the sort of revelations that doing this show has prompted, I think, for both of us was, you know, for quite a long time, sort of swallowing the conventional wisdom narrative of certain outspoken cinephiles that the 50s were kind of a dead zone, you know, like you say, that there was nothing really groundbreaking or revelatory. And then every time a guest brings us a year in the 50s, it's sort of astonishing. You know, obviously it means Hitchcock, who we will talk about. It means Kurosawa, who we will talk about. But in general, we're still in an era where you can't get right on the surface, but there's so much bubbling underneath the surface of so many of these movies.
Yes, yes. There's a lot, and it's a lot of it is paving the way for the revolution that was to come. I mean, you know, at least one of these films and at least three of these filmmakers became profound influences on the French New Wave.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, this is a really great list. We're going to get right into it. But before we do, Mike is going to walk us through some of what was going on in the supposedly uneventful world of 1954. Here's headlines.
1954, the boomer sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
When they were too young to remember how fucked up everything was. We're trying to keep it a little more upbeat, Jason, this year, Jason. So let's start with tech news, all right?
Okay.
January 7th was the first public demonstration of a machine translation system during the Georgetown IBM experiment. They made a machine with fucking punch cards, bro, that translated 60 sentences from Russian to English.
All right.
That technology has come a long way, but that's pretty good.
That's a huge start. That's a BFD, as they say.
There you go. In February, President Dwight D. Eisenhower authorized an additional $385 million in military aid to Vietnam over the $400 million already allocated for the year. Then he went and gave a speech telling us all to avoid getting caught up in Vietnam.
Right.
Presidents of the United States of America, folks. That should happen like this. That is happening this year. They might happen. Yeah. That might happen next week.
Yeah.
Also in February, the Soviet Politburo ordered the transfer of the Crimean Peninsula from the Russian state to the Ukrainian one. Huh. How about that?
Interesting.
Also in February, it was a busy month. The first mass vaccination of kids against polio was in Pittsburgh. And guess what?
Yes.
It fucking worked. What do you know?
Imagine that.
In March, it's a busy year. They say it's not, but it is. Edward R. Murrow made a whole ass documentary about how awful Senator Joe McCarthy was. So that marked the beginning of the end of a particularly dumb era.
Yes.
He had a little bit more work to do, but Arturo Toscanini had a brain fart during a concert at Carnegie Hall. And at the end of the show, he announced his retirement and never conducted in public again.
Wow.
Doug, respect.
Fair
enough. Right?
Yeah.
Here's my favorite stat of all time. Okay. April 11, 1954 has been declared the most boring day of the 20th century, boasting no significant events, births, or deaths. I'm sorry if you were born on April 11th, 1954. This website that I found has not declared your birth important. Christ, okay. Jason, we're almost out of time for headlines. All right, let me skip ahead.
Okay.
The first Burger King opened in 1954. The first Hyatt Hotel. The first commercial transistor radio from Texas Instruments. The first issue of Sports Illustrated. The first volume of The Lord of the Rings. Elvis Presley's first single. The first late night talk show. Also, not coincidentally, the first episode of The Tonight Show. That's actually two ways of saying the same thing, isn't it?
That's fine. That's close enough.
The Tonight Show was the first late night talk show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still on television.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind
of... It was. Yeah. Steve Allen, baby. You know.
There you go. And Ellis Island closed as a port of entry.
Ah,
significant.
I mean,
yeah.
They'd done a lot of work there.
They sure have.
Finally, apparently no one knows the actual date, but 1954 was the year when the Boy Scouts of America voluntarily desegregated. And without getting too dramatic about it, that's good.
Yes.
But sometimes it seems like we've made more progress on the machine translator. That's headlines.
also true. Thank you, Mike. All right, Glenn Kenny, you ready to do a top five?
Yeah. High five, more dead than alive. We're going to do this in order of how long the movies are.
I love this. A new organizing principle, longest to shortest. Perfect. So what then is the longest movie, Glenn Kenny, on your top five for 1954?
At well over 3 hours, but with an intermission built in, unlike Killers of the Flower Moon, we have Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai.
ある山間の小さな村に侍の墓が四つ並んだ。
This, like, where do you even begin on a movie that is, that I mean, is really considered one of the high watermarks of the form?
Well, you know, we begin with its epic length and also the fact that Kurosawa very overtly and blatantly stated that his ambition in making this film was to make a film that was incredibly and unceasingly entertaining. And the thing about our current state of film appreciation / consumption is that we do not, as a default, think of 3.5 hour movies as necessarily entertaining, although there are plenty of them that are. But you know, we think of 3.5 hour movies as being heavy, instructive, important, and certainly Seven Samurai is an important movie. And it is a film with a profound perspective on poverty, on community, on violence, on a lot of different topics that are still pertinent to our everyday lives. But again, Kurosawa's ambition was, well, I want to make a novel that's I want to make a film that's entertaining. And how does he make it entertaining? That's something that I tried to examine while I was watching it in preparation for this chat. And one thing that I noticed is that, you know, people talk about films as having act structures. I don't necessarily believe in that. Martin Scorsese, who I defer to on all topics, says, you know, film isn't theater. You know, don't talk about act structures in film. Nevertheless, a lot of people still do. Writers talk about it, you know, because they structure things in terms of three acts. Now, in a 3.5-hour plus movie, if you're going to think about it, act structure, it'll probably be more like five acts. But again, let's not think about the act structure. Let's think about what the movie actually does, which is something rather different, which is present a series of different self-enclosed story modules. Every, you know, the film begins, you know, for example, the part where the various, after encountering a huge amount of resistance to the very idea of defending peasants, the samurai leader then conducts auditions. And these different swordsmen come in and do their acts for him. That's one kind of narrative module that's extremely entertaining. The whole narrative module involving Toshiro Mifune's character, the rogue Kikuchiyo, who's very brash and possibly crazy and maybe not even a samurai, but definitely someone who's from the same background as the people they're going out to protect. His whole narrative story is incredible. The love story of the forbidden romance between the daughter of one of the peasants and the younger samurai is an incredible narrative module. The whole issue with the muskets, stealing of the muskets. And this kind of structure, I think, definitely created a template for subsequent long entertainments to follow. The 3.5 to 4 hours just fly by if you know what you're doing, which Kurosawa definitely did.
He definitely did. What was your first, when did you first encounter this one? Because we should say, Glenn is younger than all of the films on this list, so I am sort of curious as to when you made your way to this one.
Probably they showed it on PBS maybe in two installments. Mm-hmm. I definitely saw Yojimbo for the first time on public television. I'll never forget the dog with the hand in its mouth. I was, you know, like 8 years old. I was terrified, but I also thought, that's pretty cool, man. That's kind of badass. So, you know, you see that, you're like, well, I want to see more of this guy's movies, you know. And Seven Samurai had this reputation. I mean, obviously, in terms of reputation, in terms of classics, there are very few filmmakers like Kurosawa where, you know, it's just one great thing mm-hmm. after another. And what about this? What about that? Certainly, you know, because Rashomon, the concept of Rashomon of the, there are, you know, X number of versions of this story, my side, your side, and the truth is the word becoming emblematic of that. That's, you know, a huge Kurosawa thing. But Samurai is, you know, the longest, the most comprehensive, the one that has, you know, the most amazing performance in a career of amazing performances by Toshiro Mifune. Mm-hmm. So, you know, once you see one Kurosawa movie back in the day, and you started having conversations about Kurosawa, then it became a question was, well, did you see Seven Samurai? And I try and watch, and Seven Samurai is, you know, it's kind of, you know, like Citizen Kane and a handful of other films, it's definitely endlessly rewatchable. And I do try and watch it, you know, at least once every 5 years, definitely recharges the batteries. Yeah. If you're ever getting cynical about film, Seven Samurai is something that will really make you sit up and take notice again.
Yeah. You know, I would dare say that the next film on your list may be one of the three or four that does that most for me. So, yeah. Glenn, what then is the second longest movie on your top five for 54?
Well, we got Rear Window.
This is the scene of the crime. A crime of passion, filmed in a way you have never seen before. And as no one else would dare attempt, but the screen's master of suspense, the producer-director who shocked the world with Psycho.
Real Dead Zone. This 1954.
Yeah.
I mean, goddamn.
That's a film that we show. It kind of kicks off a lot. I teach film at NYU. I do the recitation for a lecture class called Language of Film. And the lecturer has 3 hours, and then the class is broken up into smaller groups of kids, and they come in the recitation 75 minutes. And almost without fail, the opening film is Rear Window, because among other things, it's about film. It's about watching. Yeah. It's also an incredible formal achievement. You know, one thing that we talk about when we talk about Hitchcock in to film production people is the way that Hitchcock always, you know, went through long periods of making films under self-imposed constraints, right? Mm-hmm. You got Lifeboat, which takes place on a lifeboat. How do you make that cinematically interesting? You got Rope, you know, which he tried to do as a largely, not entirely, but largely tried to simulate a single uninterrupted shot with moving camera and the equipment being so cumbersome and having to create sets where you could move the walls and all that sort of thing. And then Rear Window, which is a point of view challenge where, you know, you can't leave the point of view of your audience surrogate, who's a guy in a wheelchair who himself can't leave. So, you know, you build this whole set, and the point of view of what's happening in the apartment building across the way has to be, for the most part, the point of view of Jimmy Stewart's Jeffrey's character. So, you know, whereas in a movie theater, you know, the unspoken tacit agreement is that you are the voyeur. In Rear Window, you are with the voyeur. You're seeing from the point of view of someone who literally is a voyeur. And, you know, the movie doesn't get talked about as much as Vertigo. You know, the three great films that Jimmy Stewart made with Alfred Hitchcock are Rear Window, The Man Who Knew Too Much, which is very underrated, and of course Vertigo, which, you know, for a period, a golden 10-year period, was the acclaimed best film ever made, according to the Sight and Sound poll. And it doesn't get talked about as much as Vertigo, even though it's almost as perverse as Vertigo. Vertigo has Jimmy Stewart falling in love with a dead woman, and or even the imaginary dead woman, actually, never really died. Whereas Rear Window has Jimmy Stewart only finding out how much he values his current partner when she's about to be killed.
Right. Right.
You know, he only finds her exciting when Raymond Burr is going to, like, throttle her.
Yes.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I have a new appreciation of my girlfriend now that Raymond Burr might kill and dismember her. The thing about the movie is that Jimmy Stewart's character, who's a, you know, sports and war and racetrack photographer, a man of action, who's trying to get out of a relationship with this very gorgeous Fifth Avenue model played by Grace Kelly, is that he's so absolutely insufferable. And he's he's so mean to Grace Kelly. How can you look at Grace? It's one of the most implausible character portraits ever. How can you look at Grace Kelly and be such a prick to her? But that's kind of part, you know, but this is part of, this is one of those films, I forget if it was Robin Wood, you know, sort of parables of responsibility, where the irresponsible hero, this kind of mirrors what Hitchcock did with Roger O. Thornhill, played by Cary Grant in North by Northwest, you know, how these characters become domesticated.
Right.
You know, because by the end, Jimmy Stewart is, you know, going to marry Grace Kelly, because what the hell, dude?
Why would you not? Yes.
Yeah. So there is that. But there's also, you know, the movie has so many Hitchcock, when, you know, when everything's going right for him, everything's going right for the audience. And, you know, he had congenial relations with everybody on this crew and cast. And so you have, you know, the great lead performances by Stewart and Kelly, and remarkable support work from Thelma Ritter and Wendell Corey, across the way. There's Raymond Burr, and then of course my favorite is as the composer, Ross Bagdasarian. Ross Bagdasarian, just 1 or 2 years before he created Alvin and the Chipmunks.
And this is the link, a link between one of the greatest movies ever made and some of the worst movies ever made. I love it.
Well, that's your opinion. No, they're bad movies. Yeah. But I mean, that my kids today, they still know Alvin and the Chipmunks. So when I tell my class this, they go nuts. Yeah. I mean, they don't go nuts like they want to hear Alvin and the Chipmunks, but they're like, what?
All right. Well, yeah, Rear Window was, I think, my first Hitchcock. It's a film I saw when I was 10. And for quite some years there, it was my favorite movie of all time. It's just...
Yeah, it's great.
It's when you talk about what Hitchcock did better than anyone else in terms of his keen understanding of where to put the camera, where to focus the audience's attention, and how to do that.
Yeah.
On just on the level of basic film grammar, it's this is the one that really brings that home for my money.
Yeah, I mean it's a language of film, you know, special. So yeah, I really love it.
Very much so. All right, Glenn, what then is the third movie on your top five for 1954?
That would be Nicholas Ray. I mean, you have to kind of give a triple author, or even quadruple author, credit for this one. Johnny Guitar by Nicholas Ray.
It hits with all the violent elemental passions of a sandstorm. This story of a woman who lived and loved too hard and wanted too much, willing to fight any odds to get it.
Down there I sell whiskey and cards. All you can buy up these stairs is a bullet in the head. Now which do you want?
Starring Joan Crawford, the screen's most dynamic artist. Sterling Hayden as Johnny Guitar.
but also by Joan Crawford and by Mercedes McCambridge, and to a lesser extent by Sterling Hayden, the most perverse Western ever made, possibly before the 60s at least.
Sure.
A remarkable piece of work, kind of a chamber Western. You know, the first 38 minutes of it are all indoors. Yeah. It's a story of a woman, a sort of a woman, perhaps a nine, not binaries don't even count in this movie. This is the thing. People talk about, Johnny Guitar, it's this amazing subversive Western with a lesbian subtext. I'm like, what subtext? What? If you watch the movie, you're like, this is all right there. There's no subtext here.
Yeah.
It's text. So Mercedes McCambridge is a town woman. It's a small place out in the middle of nowhere. And of course, as is always the case, there's a railroad coming through.
Of course.
Joan Crawford's character is named Vienna, and she's built a giant bar and casino in the middle of nowhere. Because she knows the railroad is coming through, and soon this will be a town, and the town will thrive, and the town will need a bar and a casino, and she's going to clean up with this bar and casino. And but certain other business interests in the town, led by Mercedes McCambridge and a rather reluctant Ward Bond, are very opposed to Vienna's presence and her business interest. And one of these parties is played by Mercedes McCambridge, and she's crazy. She's very intense. She wears black all throughout. Her character is named Emma Small, and she's like, she's got this whole weird obsession with a outlaw with whom Joan Crawford is involved, named the Dancing Kid. But it's not really about the men.
No,
it's about
title notwithstanding. It's really not. Yeah.
Even Johnny Guitar is a kind of a non-binary name in a way.
Right. Right.
So it's crazy. And the thing about it is people talk about subversion. They talk about subtext. They talk about this. They talk about that. They also talk about camp.
Mm-hmm.
Does it have a camp kind of dimension? When you watch it, what's great is that nobody's as overstated as everything is,
right,
and it is quite overstated. Nobody's actually winking at the camera. The overstatement is with some sort of unusual, perhaps confused conviction, but nobody's doing nudge, nudge, wink, wink, look at us being subversive. It's all like, It's very, you know, high Wagnerian melodrama that they and they're not like they're not being cute. This is just it. They believe in the emotions that they're propagating here.
Yeah,
you know, and that's part of what makes it great.
Yeah,
and then the ending is just insane.
Yes, yes, it is. This is one of many great movies that I first was made aware of via the aforementioned Martin Scorsese's personal journey through American cinema docu-series, miniseries, if you ever get a chance to see it. And the thing
and then if you see Johnny Guitar, it's very intense.
Yes. Yes. And the thing that he talked about that really stuck with me when I finally made my way to it was the use of color in this thing is sort of semi-obscene. Like it's really stark and saturated, and the extent to which Ray is using color to tell the story is something that I think is still sort of unusual today, even.
Oh, no, he slathers it on. And at the end, I don't want to spoil anything, but a certain edifice at the end does go up in flames. And he gets all the footage they shot of that fire is used in the film, despite it's almost like they're looping past the place just to make sure you get to see the fire. They get full value out of the destruction of this one building. And it takes on a very hellish kind of appearance after a certain point.
Maybe even an inspiration for a similar fire sequence in Mr. Scorsese's latest picture. Who's to say?
In Killers of the Flower Moon, perhaps.
Quite possibly so.
Yeah.
I feel like this is a movie that you see in sort of, or at least I don't know. I feel like I saw this in sort of movie montages.
Yes.
Yeah. For a long time before I actually saw it. And, you know, you see this shot, like, especially for a kid who may have interned at a music theater as a teenager on a on a production of Paint Your Wagon. You see just sort of like an out of context shot of her standing by an obviously fake, like, giant fence post with a painted backdrop. And it's very easy to dismiss. But then when you actually watch the movie and you see the same thing in context, mm-hmm. like you're watching the two of them, you know, have a communication, and the sort of fence post is not the relevant thing in the movie. When you actually see those moments in context, there's a point where the scene where she's literally in a white dress playing a piano and says like, and you're all here in your funeral clothes, like the sort of, you know, the symbology of it couldn't be more obvious. But I found that. And so anyway, I just was sort of surprised by over and over and over these sort of what feel like obvious things out of context that are actually really powerful when you're letting the storyteller tell the story.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Okay, so the next film on your list, Glenn, is also a film I first heard about from a different Scorsese docuseries. What is the fourth longest film on your top five for 54?
That would be Journey in Italy.
This is the first time that we've been really alone ever since we married. I don't think you're very happy when we're alone.
Are you sure you know when I'm happy?
Ever since we left on this trip, I'm not so sure.
It's a film by Roberto Rossellini. One of the three films that he made with Ingrid Bergman after their scandalous, at least in the United States, you know, liaison. We all know the story of how Ingrid Bergman, at the height of her Hollywood career, wrote Roberto Rossellini a fan letter and said, hey, if you could use a rangy Swedish broad in one of your films, hook me up. I don't think that's exactly how she put it, but something along those lines.
I've got a book right here. That's the verbatim quote. Well done, Glenn. Well done.
But Rossellini, who was, you know, aside from being a great, inspired, genius filmmaker and passionate, artist, also a real hustler and often broke beyond belief, saw an opportunity there. He had Bergman come to Italy, and not only did she agree to work with him, but they fell in love. Mm-hmm. They had some kids, several of whom you may have heard of. And, you know, for doing this while she was still married to Peter Lindstrom, Ingrid Bergman became a huge scandal in America and was denounced on the floor of Congress. Not by Joe McCarthy, but by someone less memorable and equally risible.
Like-minded individuals, yeah.
And unfortunately, that scandal kind of obscured the value of the work they did together, which was mighty fine, including Stromboli. And this is, I think, the most popular and most well-known of the three films. Also, it's relatively accessible because it was released in a because it starred English language actors. It didn't play as one of them damn foreign films with the subtitles that's always getting dragged by neckbeards on TikTok these days. But Journey in Italy is about a European couple who are very alienated from each other. They are not they sure aren't getting along. And they're on a tour through Italy, but they're also doing some business there. And during the during the trip, they decide rather matter-of-factly that, well, now we're going to get divorced. Yeah. It's the story of how they don't get divorced. George Sanders is really remarkable in it because it's the closest I've ever seen to him giving a naturalistic performance. And even giving a naturalistic performance, he's very George Sanders, because that kind of high-blown, slightly snooty person is who he actually was. But he's a lot less, there's very little stylization in his performance. It's his boredom, his jadedness are all, put forward with very little elaboration. And it makes it all the more moving at the end when his character has to be vulnerable. I mean, you're used to seeing Ingrid Bergman being vulnerable, but not George Sanders. And I think his performance is really what kind of, this is a definite, you will cry in the last 5 minutes of the film, or else you are perhaps not human. But it's more his vulnerability is even more moving than Bergman's, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's a really interesting film. You know, Rossellini is always interesting stylistically because, he keeps to a certain mode, but he also varies it to a certain extent. When Ingrid Bergman's character is going through this museum and she's looking at the sculptures, the imagery and the camera movements have hints of Cocteau, and it's unusual to see Rossellini use such flourishes, but when the mood met him and he was feeling it, he would apply them because they're right. They really put things across. And like every other Rossellini film from this period, the seams are very visible. During the lava demonstration scene, the post dubbing, you can hear the echo of the recording booth and the dialogue. Right. It's not, I show Paisan or portions of Paisan to my class. And I, as a demonstration of how, even with really rough edges, technically, a great filmmaker can really put across something very emotionally affecting. That's in evidence throughout Paisan, but it's also very much in evidence in A Journey in Italy. It led me to the conclusion that this is a great film that is great maybe as much due to its errors as in spite of its errors, because the film itself shows its own vulnerability as much as the characters do, which is not a theory that I'm prepared to elaborate on too much, but it did occur to me as a notion.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense to me. It gets at the just sort of moment to moment prickliness of a marriage in trouble in ways that are much more subtle than most films on that topic do. He's not overstating this stuff, but you can feel the tension between them in really interesting ways, I think.
Yeah. And it tells you, step back, halt. Mm-hmm. It's very wise. It's a film of great wisdom.
Agreed.
Great life wisdom,
Agreed.
And also a great feeling. Really terrific stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say there are a lot of life lessons in the fifth and final film, film.
In your
top five. So what are we going to wrap it up with, Glenn?
That's the great Jack Arnold's Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Hell yes.
Science couldn't explain it, but there it was, alive in the deep, deep waters of the Amazon. A throwback to a creature that had existed 100 million years ago, immensely strong and destructive. A woman's beauty, the bait that brought it out of its lair. See underwater thrills never photographed before. See titanic underwater battles never dreamed of before in this most terrifying of the science fiction adventures.
Only an hour and 15 minutes or so.
Tight as a drum.
The life lesson, I think, is summed up in, again, talking about internet memes. There's that one meme that someone assembled, a montage of shots from all three creature films, which, lest you need your memory refreshed would be A Creature from the Black Lagoon, The Revenge of the Creature, and the very bizarre Creature Walks Among Us, in which the creature is transformed to something that looks rather like Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now. but, you know, that, a lot of shots of that creature like hitting people and things and animals. Right. So, with subtitled "Fuck this, fuck that, fuck this guy too, fuck that, and fuck you too." I mean, right. And that is, you know, that's kind of the life. That's kind of the life, the wisdom of the creature films. You know, it's funny. Honestly, you know, this is a childhood film. Obviously, Rico Browning, amazing swimmer. I sent him a card while he was ailing and during his last days because we were instructed to do so, and I sent him a physical greeting card thanking him for his swimming. It was very entertaining. And the creature just looked fucking cool, right? He looks super fucking cool. There's no fucking way that any of the science put forward in the movie to explain the existence of the creature holds up or makes any sense whatsoever. Nope. And they might as well have not even tried, but they try so much. They try with the whole opening,
That adaption ass opening, remember the part in adaptation when he's trying to start the script and he does movie does
in the beginning, you know, Genesis, and you know, really no scientific explanation for a fishman. You just can't do it. Nor is there, you know, and also, why is the fishman so horny?
He really wants
that Julia Adams and
Are there no fish ladies?
Apparently not.
I like the dialogue though. I like the idea of an Amazonian rat that is as big as a sheep. I like the fact that Nestor Paiva, who we'd later see in the great They Saved Hitler's Brain, is in the cast.
Of course.
The whole scientist rivalry for the affections of Julie Adams is great. And the music, all that great stuff. Story. I mean, it's a perfect creature feature. It literally is a creature feature because Frankenstein is a creature, but this guy's an evolutionary creature, despite having no scientific basis in reality, but still. He's a error of evolution, whereas Frankenstein's monster is an error of scientific stuff. so he is truly a creature, whereas Frankenstein is a monster. So you had them when you were growing up. I'm rather old, but you had the model, the Aurora model that you could put together. I had a very good friend who was very accomplished at putting together models and. Either the Phantom and the Creature and Frankenstein. And then the Prisoner from Castle Mar, which nobody really knew what the fuck he was because it wasn't in the movie. Right. But it was part of the Aurora model set. Nice. So yeah, the Creature from the Black Lagoon is a part of my nostalgia kit, let's say. But, I watched it. I watched every movie on this list about a week and a half ago. And, it holds up. It moves. It moves like a motherfucker.
It sure does. Yeah. And I will also say, too, kudos to Universal Home Video for making this one available in its 3D version, which is the one that I watch whenever I revisit, which I did for this one. I love that first wave of 3D where they were not even pretending to be artisans about it.
Oh,
it was just like, let's just throw shit at the lens. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I love it. Yeah.
Beautiful. All right. Well, Glenn, thank you so much for that first rate top five. Now let's find out a little bit about the big doings of the entertainment business in the year 1954. Here's Mike with the Hollywood Minute.
Hollywood freaks from the Hollywood scene.
The award sensation of 1954 was On the Waterfront, which won Oscars for Best Picture, Best Director Alia Kazan, Best Actor Marlon Brando, Best Supporting Actress Eva Marie Saint, and Best Original Screenplay for Bud Schoenberg, and did nearly as well at the 12th Golden Globes. Damn, son.
Glenn, thoughts on the Waterfront?
Great film, but, Eliza Kazan, is a whole, his whole rationale for cooperating with Yuuk. Boo, hiss.
Yeah, it's a little sticky.
Pretty good movie, although, and Maestro chooses to just completely ignore which is unusual. Why bring it up and then just not show it? But that's Bradley Cooper for you. It's a fine film. It's a landmark Brando performance. It was shot in Hoboken, where I myself have spent a lot of time and will spend more time. It's a great little town across the East River. It's got a lot to recommend it, but if I'm being honest, it didn't even occur to me to put it on my top five list.
There we go.
That's an interesting thing for me to face in my in my self-examination.
Other Oscar winners included The Country Girl, which won Oscars for Grace Kelly for Best Actress, and George Seton for adapting Clifford Odets' play, and The Barefoot Contessa, which won Edmund O'Brien a trophy for Best Supporting Actor.
Glenn, where do you land on those two?
The Country Girl is actually a genuinely bad film. I defy you.
I've heard this. I've heard this.
I defy you to watch it and say it's a good film. So that's interesting. Barefoot Contessa, on the other hand, is one of those film
modi. Yeah.
And I did the liner notes for a Arrow re-release of that, and I had a lovely time researching that. One of the weirdest Rosano Brazzi performances ever. It's a whole thing. Great stuff. Really interesting, you know, it's only 1954, Joe Mankiewicz. Are you really that bitter about Hollywood? if you remember, you know, Joe Mankiewicz's big decades were the late 40s and early 50s, but he goes all the way back to the 30s, so he had plenty to get bitter over.
He sure did. Yeah. No, I've heard that about The Country Girl, and so I think we can all just pretend like Grace Kelly won it for Rear Window and call it a day.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
The year's biggest commercial hit was White Christmas. Other box office hits of 54 included The Caine Mutiny, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and The Glenn Miller Story.
The music biopic, packing them in since the 50s, baby.
An Anthony Mann music biopic.
Yeah. Where do you land on that one?
Oh, I love it. It's the only movie that actually has a depiction of the great music theorist Schillinger, whose music theory was used by a lot of classical composers, including my good friend Michael Rouse. It's a whole system of composition that was used by Glenn Miller, and Schillinger is actually made into a character in this film. I think he's played by some character actor who also played a made especially playing wise little goateed men, and I think played one in Torn Curtain or not. Let me look this up. But Anthony Mann always delivers, and Jimmy Stewart is and June Allison, very wholesome couple. They were also in the FBI Story together.
Sounds right.
Louis Armstrong's in it. Gene Krupa's in it. A lot of good music. I mean, you think, the Glenn Miller Story, how good can it be? It's better than you think.
There you go.
Yeah. I'm still looking for this dude. He's definitely in here though. And, it was White Christmas is good too. That's Michael Curtiz. Yes.
Yes. Very much so.
Yeah. Leo Mastavoy plays, Schillinger. And he's also in The Man Called X and Song of Russia, One Girl's Confession, Silk Stockings. So, yeah, he played a lot of bearded guys with spectacles. and was, in fact, born in Russia. So there
we go. There we go.
1954 saw the birth of Rene Russo, star of Jason's beloved Thomas Crown Affair remake.
Yep.
Ron Howard, director of Jason's beloved The Paper.
Yep.
John Travolta, star of Pulp Fiction, which Jason wrote a whole ass book about.
Can you tell I wrote this segment?
Here? Simpsons creator Matt Groening, actual comic genius Catherine O'Hara, directors Joel Cohen, Amy Heckerling, and Ang Lee, Heat co-star Dennis Haysbert, Kathleen Turner, Jim Belushi, David Paymer, Denzel goddamn Washington, the late great Ray Liotta, star of Goodfellas, read Glenn's book, 5 out of 4 stars, and the one, the only, the legend, Mr. Jackie Chan.
Hey-o.
And in 1954, we said goodbye to Casablanca and Maltese Falcon co-star Sidney Greenstreet, Mr. Potter himself, Lionel Barrymore, Cinerama inventor Fred Waller, John Eberson, architect of many of America's most ornate movie palaces, including our own hometown prize, the Wichita Orpheum. And Will Hayes, the namesake of the Hayes Code, and really, truly, fuck that guy. That's the Hollywood Minute.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Mike. Glenn, you ready to do a lightning round?
Sure, let's do it.
All right, you know how it works. I'm going to feed you a list of titles. You can comment briefly on each or pass if you wish. Here we go. A Star is Born.
Oh, good. Very good. James Mason. The first Star is Born was William Wellman. Frederick March was the Alky in that. It was made. You felt bad for Norman Maine because he didn't. He didn't have any AA meetings to go to. James Mason's character doesn't have the same excuse and nevertheless suffers the same fate. George Cukor and Judy Garland both working together at the height of their powers, despite the fact that the film was butchered upon its release and never properly restored. It's still something to see.
Humphrey Bogart and Audrey Hepburn in Sabrina.
A real drag. For some reason, Humphrey Bogart never really gets any energy in this movie and seems to not have his heart in it. And it really makes the May-December aspect of the romance even more eyebrow-raising. I won't insult you by using the word problematic than it would be otherwise. Even William Holden seems somewhat at sea here. This is a problem that would continue to dog director Billy Wilder when he made Love in the Afternoon with Gary Cooper and Audrey Hepburn, and a film for which Gary Cooper was not eating his honey bunches of oats during the making of Love in the Afternoon, and it definitely shows. So I it's hard to sit through for me.
Magnificent Obsession.
Oh, Douglas Sirk, good stuff. Rock Hudson, Jane Wyman, Eye Surgery, with those four components, you cannot not make a classic.
We had another Hitch movie in 1954, little gem called Dial M for Murder.
Pretty good, not as good as Rear Window. That was Hitch's own experiment in 3D, and he did bring the artistry to it. The thing about that movie is that he really didn't have a clue of what to do in the courtroom scene, so he has them over this weird, swirling, psychedelic background that it can very infrequently can it be said of a Hitchcock effect that it doesn't work at all, but in this case, doesn't work at all. But the murder scene and the scissors in 3D and what's his nut? That guy, the guy who plays the murderer for hire, Anthony Dawson, who's also in Dr. No. He gets it. You've had your six in Dr. No. You've had your six guy. So, and he just can't get a break in the 50s and 60s in terms of formidable foes. He tries to kill Grace Kelly in this and ends up dead himself. And then in Dr. No, Bond really gives it to him. But that's a great scene. Ray Milland is super oily. There's some great things in it. There are very few Hitchcock movies in which you could say there are no great things in it. But overall, it's unlike Rear Window, which is a formal exercise that feels like an organic narrative because it combines strong aspects of both. This feels much more like a formal exercise.
We had two by Otto Preminger in 54, Carmen Jones and River of No Return.
Yeah, neither is really highly rated by Premingerites, and Carmen Jones is certainly something that has a lot of issues, one being the fact that, neither Dorothy Dandridge nor Harry Belafonte, a professional singer, neither was allowed to sing their own in their own voices in the film because the score was too operatic for them, ostensibly. The only singer singing in their own voice is Pearl Bailey. You got to give Preminger points for making this, though. You got to give Preminger points for making a film with an all-black cast in 1954. And you got to give him points for not employing a lot of egregious racial stereotyping that you see even in as well-intentioned a film as, say, Cabin in the Sky from over 10 years prior by Vincent Minnelli.
Right.
The big highlight of the movie is the appearance of Max Roach in a nightclub scene doing his thing. He's fantastic. The sequence leading up to that is Pearl Bailey beat out that rhythm on the drugs. That's really good. Dorothy Dandridge is beautiful. The camera work is exquisite. You know, Preminger, always the master of the long take. River of No Return, I think, if you don't know it and you've heard that it's lesser Preminger, go and watch it. It holds up a lot better than you'd expect, and Marilyn Monroe's performance in particular is really understated and interesting.
Fellini's La Strada.
What are you going to say? It's Fellini's La Strada. You know, it was it's Fellini before he became Fellini-esque. It's Fellini in a more realist mode, but it's also like almost over-determined to rip your heart out, which it does. And, you know, amazing work by Giuliana Messina, Anthony Quinn, Richard Basehart.
And finally, Sam Fuller's Hell and High Water.
I actually don't know that one. I have it, but I've never watched it.
And finally, David Lean's Hobson's Choice.
That's a great one. That's, you know, people don't associate David Lean with comedy. But this is a full-on, you know, it's a British human comedy, obviously, but it is a full-on comedy. It's very funny. It's maybe Charles Laughton's best on-screen performance, you know.
Wow.
I mean, in terms of subtlety, certainly.
Yeah.
I mean, he's great in Advise and Consent, but in Advise and Consent, he's just like, just baking that ham, you know. Shamelessly throughout, and it suits the character because the character is this kind of performative, not buffoon, but, you know, performative type. But in Hobson's Choice, he's really, the character is different and differently built, and he's beautifully nuanced in that.
Beautiful. All right, Glenn, excellent work on the lightning round. Where can people follow you on social media and or read your work?
I'm on Twitter under Glenn Kenny, and you know, you can find my stuff pretty much once a week at rogerebert.com and in the New York Times, or you could enroll at NYU and take my class.
There you go.
I also teach classes at the 92nd Street Wise Roundtable online series, and I think next fall, I'll be doing a seminar on Humphrey Bogart. So,
hey,
look for that.
Yeah. And the book, again, is The World is Yours, The Story of Scarface. And it gets the Very Good Year seal of approval. Check it out.
All right. Thank you.
I am Fun City Cinema on Instagram, Jason-Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd, where you can find under my list the top fives for every episode of the show. Mike, where can people find you?
I am on Twitter at BrainwashedLib, and on Blue Sky is Fifth Column Films.
And of course, if you like the show and think other people might like it too, please do leave us a rating and or a review on your podcatcher of choice and help us stand out just a little bit amongst the comical crush of movie podcasts. Mike, before we go, what is your favorite movie of 1954?
Bro, we made it to the end of the 1954 episode and the word Godzilla has not been said yet.
Hey! And,
if I was going to write a book that I didn't actually want anybody to buy, I would write, or like if I was gonna get a PhD in film at my advanced age, I would write about Japanese movies from like basically the end of World War II until like the mid 60s, because the sort of obviously we talked about Seven Samurai today, you know, Tokyo Story came out like 6 months before that. There's sort of the movies that are being made, but not just the movies that are being made, but the political and social universe of Japan after World War II is just so incredibly rich and interesting, and the movies that they made and the way those things express themselves, I think, are just sort of, you know, like we talked about the movie skipping my mind right now. I compared it to the 12 Angry, to Japan's 12 Angry Men. What's the name of the movie?
Oh, Death by Hanging.
Death by Hanging, right? And like we talked about sort of all the political things that were potentially sort of in that movie that are impossible for us to draw out now. And, you know, as Americans and all these other things, but the way the sort of the culture and the politics were being expressed in film at that time, the movies are great. That shit is a bottomless well that you could dig into that just make the movies, you know, so much more interesting in a lot of different ways. And Godzilla is one of those. It's a great movie. You can just dig it. I mean, it's, you know, it's, there's a reason why it spawned its own version of movies. I mean, like there's what I think there was two Godzilla movies last year. There was at least one really big budget one, you know?
And not bad at all.
I mean, the fact that it sort of has been reinterpreted in so many ways is interesting in its own, but when you find, when you sort of dig into the subtext and all the nuclear shit and everything that, that is wrapped up in that 54 Godzilla, it's just, I mean, it's a study of its own. I could spend the rest of my life just sort of digging into that world. And it, and Godzilla is a really, the idea that Godzilla and Seven Samurai came out, you know, sort of as cultural expressions of that same aftermath, sort of in the same time, is just, I can't.
And these are all, these are all occupation films. The films made in Japan during the American occupation are themselves quite fascinating.
Yeah.
And that, that sort of thing of like, what did we allow them to do? What were they doing that we didn't know that they sort of weren't asking permission for? I mean, like our cultural incompetency in that sort of, in that space is its own. There's fucking, anyway, I love it, dude. And then you can just watch it. It's just a great movie. But if you want to go dig in.
People might buy that book. That's not an entirely outrageous idea for a book.
There you go.
And Godzilla, who knows? Godzilla is a good boy. He's a good boy.
He is a good boy. That's very true.
How about you, Jason?
I'm going to go with, as I mentioned, Rear Window is one of my favorite movies ever. So, like, aside from that, I'm going to go with Naked Alibi, starring Johnny Guitar himself, Sterling Hayden. And It's a Wonderful Life, Gloria Graham,
right? Yeah, Gloria Graham, who was married to Nicholas Ray.
See, so we got all sorts of connections here. Yeah, Gloria Graham is, I've long said that I think Louise Brooks is the sexiest woman who's ever been in a movie, but I think Gloria Graham is like a real close second. Like that first entrance in It's a Wonderful Life, like there's literally an awooga horn. Like I'll watch anything that Gloria Graham does. And this one is really fascinating because it starts as sort of a pretty kind of flat-footed, sort of post-Naked City police procedural kind of thing. And then about a half hour in, it becomes this really seedy, like border town noir situation with Gloria Graham as like, you know, a slinky nightclub singer. And it's like it's got all of these sort of late noir tropes, but they're done so well. And I'll just watch Sterling Hayden and Gloria Graham in a scene together saying literally anything. It's a really terrific little noir that's worth seeking out. Thank you again, Glenn.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you so much. Been a lot of fun.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening.
It was a very good year.